Hey, can you hear me now? Verizon, AOL, and memories of mergers past from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us, everybody. It is Tuesday, the 12th of May today. And please, stop me if you've heard this one before, all right? The stock market's doing really well. Silicon Valley and online anything, really, is the space to be in. And AOL has just gotten bought up in a multi-billion dollar merger. Sound familiar? Yeah, I thought so. In a deal with faint echoes of the, I do think it's fair to say, disastrous AOL-Time Warner merger of 15 years ago, Verizon said this morning it's going to buy AOL for $4.4 billion American dollars. Our tech correspondent, Molly Wood, is here to unpack this whole thing a little bit. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai. How are you?
I'm good. Help me understand, though, what this deal is all about, would you?
You know, this is a deal about Verizon realizing, like AT&T and Comcast realized before, that they can't make money by being a plumber. They can't make money selling access to the internet, whether it's wireless or broadband internet. And they're trying to figure out how they can get into the super hot mobile video and, more importantly, mobile advertising space.
And that's what AOL does. AOL has some secret sauce on mobile ads.
AOL does. They have very good technology for what is called, this is very much the hot thing right now, programmatic advertising, which is finding a way to take a mobile video and put it in exactly the right place with exactly the right ad in front of it to get that targeted demographic. They're very good at that. Yeah. And they've also invested a lot in original content. So Verizon is interested in maybe putting out its own mobile video service, getting subscribers attracted that way, and then, of course, making a lot of money by selling ads on those videos.
Without getting too far down into the weeds, why is programmatic ad placement or whatever you said so hard?
It's hard because it's hard to find the users where they are. So AOL made some good investments. They bought a company called 5min, which does video distribution and uses data from other websites to make sure that videos are reaching the right audience. But it's sort of hard to know who those audiences are, how often they're watching, and when they're watching. And that's where the ad technology part comes in.
If I am not a Verizon subscriber and I get my internet from somewhere other than AOL, as most people do, what does this deal mean for me?
It might mean something to you if you are a Verizon wireless customer. Mm-hmm. So if you get your cell phone service through Verizon, then all of a sudden you might have a new internet streaming video service. Now, Verizon has said that they want to launch basically a mobile TV service as soon as this summer. So if you're a subscriber already, you might benefit from that. And if you're with AT&T, you might be tempted to go to Verizon and check out this new streaming service. It might also mean on the back end, if you are a user, that they start tracking you a lot more closely than they already have been, which I should say is a lot.
Yeah, is really closely. was your thought the same as mine when you heard about this thing this morning, which was, oh, my God, AOL in a deal. It's a bubble. What are we going to do?
Kind of. Yeah. Although it's a pretty.
I mean, it's
big
a total.
Drop
yeah, it's a totally
AOL.
Different beast, right? And it's not $100 bajillion and all that stuff. But still.
Yeah. Well, it says something about the excitement around ad technology. That has been something that people are legitimately calling a bubble because there's such desperation to figure out the right technology to target ads, to make sure they're being delivered, to make sure people are seeing them. And yeah, everyone is trying to be both the content provider and the platform. But I got to give AOL some credit because they built up what I think most people thought was a carcass bubble merger into a pretty legit ad tech and content company. And that's an expensive and difficult task.
Really quickly, before I let you go, there is some ancillary content on the AOL side in this deal. I'm thinking Huffington Post and TechCrunch. That just kind of probably gets spun off and it's not the guts of this thing.
That's the speculation, is that some of that content will get spun off. And to be honest, regulators, as they look closely at this, they might say they have to spin off the content, that it's a little touchy for Verizon to be in the content business. But both of those sites produce video, so Verizon might want it.
Molly Wood, she is our senior tech correspondent. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure.
As tends to happen when big deals like this are announced, the acquisitioner lost ground today. Verizon off about a 3% plus or minus. The acquisitionee, however, went on a tear. AOL rose a bit more than 18% in trading today. The broader markets, they just about broke even. But forget stocks for a minute, would you? And let's talk about what really matters here, everybody. Bonds. The usually reliably boring bond market has been distinctly unboring of late. What began in German Bunds a week or two ago has arrived at the U.S. Treasury market. Prices are way down, which means yields, that is, interest rates, are up. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson takes it from there.
You know how some people would be thrilled if their friends threw them a surprise party, but lots of others would be less than thrilled? Guess which type the bond market is.
The bond market doesn't like surprises.
Brian Railing is with the Wells Fargo Investment Institute, and he says the host responsible for the surprise likely has a German accent.
We saw Germany really start to move higher in interest rates, almost a 0.5% move, which is a big move in bond world. And that's really what's moved U.S. rates higher.
High interest rates in Europe impact our rates here. And not just the bond market, says Guy Labat, chief fixed income strategist at Janney Montgomery Scott.
So a bank, for example, can go out there and buy a bond, or they can make a mortgage loan. And if the returns they get on bonds are higher, because interest rates have risen, they're going to require a higher interest rate on that same mortgage loan.
We could list a whole conga line of ramifications.
Oh, yes, this surprise party has a conga line. Marion Cohen is president of Envision Capital Management. She says in addition to mortgage rates,
car loans, less sensitive than mortgage rates, but certainly will drift up. Any type of consumer loan or line of credit that you may have that you're thinking about using a portion of, those rates would go up.
Cohen doesn't think we'll see big rate increases, but lots of the economy is counting on low interest rates. On the flip side, higher interest rates mean it's a decent time to buy bonds. They'll offer more income now. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Here's a bond market number of note today. The yield on the 10-year Treasury sits this Tuesday, and remember, it starts from a low base at 2.25%. That is the highest the yield there has been since last year. We'll have the rest of the details when we do the numbers. The oil field services firm Baker Hughes has been providing a non-oil service to the drilling industry since 1944, a weekly count of the number of active drilling rigs out there doing their thing. Last Friday's number was down 11 rigs from a week earlier, continuing a slide in rig count that started back in December when crude prices pretty much bottomed out. Lower prices make for less drilling, obviously, which makes for fewer workers. And in places like North Dakota, where the boom was pretty strong, fewer workers makes for less housing demand, which in turn makes for some problems. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that story.
There was a time when the Capitol Lodge man camp outside Tioga, North Dakota, was teeming with oil field workers, as many as 1,000 of them. Sometimes they made local headlines for getting into brawls. So I was expecting a little bit of rowdiness when I visited recently. Instead, I found a nearly empty cafeteria with a TV blaring.
From my experience as a bow hunter, it's easy to fear those things that you can't control.
In recent months, Capitol Lodge has made local headlines again for really different reasons this time. The owners are looking to downsize. Occupancy over the winter months was down as much as 70% from its peak.
This facility here has slowed down dramatically.
Tony Miller is an oil field production worker who's been staying at the Capitol Lodge, and he says the place is a ghost town these days.
When I first started coming here, it was right around December. You would wait in line to get food, and now it's kind of come and go as you please. And there's six rooms in the building that I stay in, and I've been the only one in the building for at least 2 months.
Four guys shoot pool in the rec area, and a couple others eat steak in the dining room. And Miller says this is actually the busiest he's seen the place in a long time. The reasons why are obvious to him. Oil field companies have been laying off workers, cutting their hours, sometimes slashing their housing subsidies.
The time might come where I go to work one morning and they say, guess what? Now you don't have a job. Just wait until that day comes and hopefully it don't come.
An energy economist I talked to, Ed Herz, says drilling rig counts and payrolls are dropping throughout the oil fields in North Dakota's Bakken area and in Texas, where he's based. And he says man camps in both those states are feeling the brunt of it.
We know that the rates that they charge per day have dropped in some cases by more than half. It really doesn't matter what the rate is. They don't have anyone there to pay $10 a day, let alone $100 a day.
Now, Hers points out that these man camps were always meant to be temporary. They're supposed to be replaced by permanent apartments and homes. But he says even some of those permanent projects are in trouble.
I've talked to one real estate developer who started a $30 million project in the heart of the Bakken with the idea that, you know, heck, this thing might be worth $60 million. But now they're looking at trying to make do with less than half the projected occupancy and perhaps less than half the projected rental rates.
Well, there's been an increase in the homes on the market.
Dave Nordenstrom is the president of a builders association in Williston, the capital city of North Dakota's oil patch. When the group met recently for dinner, Nordenstrom said that the inventory of homes for sale was up as much as 25%, but he didn't actually seem that worried about it.
As time goes on here a little bit, that'll shake out and builders will slow down some of their production.
Like a lot of people in North Dakota, Nordenstrom says a bit of a break from the manic pace of the oil boom is probably a good thing. And he's pretty confident that the gravy days aren't over.
The oil isn't going anywhere. It's still going to be here.
Builders still seem pretty busy at this new housing development in Williston. At one intersection, the road weirdly just ends in mud. Down below in the valley, there's eventually going to be new roads and a new high school. These were projects that were launched when the oil industry was still booming. But now, with the oil boom on hold, a lot of people will have their fingers crossed that these projects still make economic sense. In the North Dakota oil patch, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's a huge business, and it's also, you know, predicated on change, because if it didn't change, then we wouldn't need to buy anything new.
Fashion and fashion journalism straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 36 points today, about 0.2%, ended things at 18,068, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ off 17 points, 0.3%. Ended things at 49.76. The S&P 500 dipped 6 points, 0.3%, closed at 2,099. Cloud computing firm Rackspace Hosting floated down 13.5%. They missed revenue estimates for the first quarter and lowered expectations for the coming quarter. Also, the strong dollar, they said, was partly to blame. Exchange rates also hurt Gap. The clothing retailer shed 3.75% in first quarter. Revenue fell as those foreign currency sales were changed back to greenbacks. International flavors and fragrances wafted down 4.1%, reported better than expected first quarter earnings today, but also warned, wait for it, the strong dollar could bring down sales. Bond prices rose, as I said, the yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.25%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Have you been buying supplies to get your yard or garden in shape? The Commerce Department reports on retail sales for April. Citizens Against Government Waste releases its annual Congressional Pig Book. And it's time to buckle down and study. 10 super smart students compete in the final round of the National Geographic Bee. The winner gets $50,000 for college so they can study some more. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The National Football League has indeed suspended Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. 4 games is the total. That despite what many, present company included, thought would happen, namely nothing. The team has been hit as well for using underinflated footballs in this year's playoffs. It's a move that some say preserves the integrity of the game. The National Basketball Association, meanwhile, is looking at the integrity of its game as it moves through the playoffs. Slowly through the playoffs, it should be said. There's been a rash this year of what's come to be known as the Hacka Shack after one Shaquille O'Neal, that is, intentionally fouling a guy known to be lousy at free throws. Yes, it's legal, but it's fouling up the business of the game, Gigi Duban reports.
First, there was Hacka Shack. Most recently, it's Hacka Jordan, also known as Hacka DeAndre. That's for L.A. Clippers center DeAndre Jordan. Amazing player, but yes, terrible at free throws. Here's a clip from his rookie days.
Did you believe that DeAndre free throw? Jordan. Did you just see what I saw? Wide left. It was like a gust of wind that blew through here.
Hack-a-Shack, or Hack-a-Whoever, is when a team targets the opposition's worst free throw shooter, pounding him with fouls. He has to take the free throw. He misses. The other team gets the ball. Rodney Paul teaches sport management at Syracuse University.
This kind of drags it down, and probably my guess would be the NBA would be looking at, well, how could we keep that excitement without having some of these games really have that type of slow finish that might not be as interesting to fans.
And with the NHL playoffs, baseball season, and 1,000 other things going on, the NBA faces stiff competition for viewers. Tom Rhodes teaches economics at Towson University. He says banning hack-a-shacks would make the game less frustrating for fans, but take away a key tactic.
You have certain rules that are really designed for the fan and not for the players.
The constant stops in action aren't good for advertisers either, says Rodney Fort. He teaches sport management at the University of Michigan. Fort says breaks ought to be predictable.
And if you can't tell for sure when the breaks in the action are going to be, you have a difficult time identifying the number of slots to sell to advertisers.
He says the NBA, like other major sports leagues, has been pretty good at changing the rules to make more money. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
We've come now to that part of the program where economics runs headlong into Newton's third law of motion, which I'll just go ahead and remind you here in case you forgot, is the one that says, for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Yes, paraphrasing. Hospitals have been moving toward electronic medical records the past couple of years, in part because of the Affordable Care Act. Online health data was supposed to be an upgrade, but it often somehow feels more like Windows 95 than using an iPhone, which has led to the return of a very old specialty indeed, the scribe. From Wyoming Public Radio, Miles Bryan reports.
If the word scribe rings any bells, you're probably thinking of something like this.
Annie's position as scribe tells us he was part of an educated group.
Okay, that's the History Channel. Put that out of your mind. This story is set in 2015, and it's about a new kind of scribe.
And you said this has been going on for how long?
About a week. And it's got worse last night. Yeah.
Got any worse. Okay.
In the ER of Cheyenne, Wyoming's main hospital, Dr. Amy Tortorich is checking out a patient who came in with chest pains. Her dedicated medical scribe, Tyrell Kirchhofer, is taking notes on his laptop in the back of the room. It's the only sound he makes, and he's not just quiet.
One of the biggest things that they taught us was not to show any facial expressions in the room, which takes a lot of work.
Kirchhofer's job is to record everything about a patient's visit. He makes $13 an hour, and it's good experience for a guy trying to get into med school. Kirchhofer says he's gotten to see some interesting stuff as a scribe, like when a woman showed up after getting run over by a bull.
She didn't come in for 12 hours or something crazy like that because she didn't think it was that bad. She had a wound that was the size of a large orange or a grapefruit.
The hospital had to adopt electronic medical records by this year in order to not get dinged on Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement. That's why Kirchhofer has this job. These records are way more comprehensive than the paper files or computer spreadsheets the hospital used to use, so they take a lot longer. Dr. Tortorich says it takes her about 10 minutes per patient. If you work in an ER, that adds up.
So without Tyrell, you could be spending
an extra 5 hours charting. So half my shift, almost half my shift.
But with Kirchhofer, she can see more patients and they leave happier, which she says makes him well worth the money.
All of my hospital doctor friends, they want this.
That kind of demand has created a booming industry. Sarah Lamb is with Scribe America, one of the biggest medical scribe companies in the country.
Over the past year alone, we have tripled our growth to probably just under 7,500 employees across 47 states.
The leading scribe trade group predicts the number of scribes in this country will go from about 20,000 today to 100,000 by the end of the decade. And Lamb says she's confident that kind of growth will continue.
Unless we have some futuristic component where a physician can do live documentation while walking down the hall, there will always be a need for scribes.
Wait, why can't we have that? Dr. George Gellert thinks we can, but he says to get there, we might have to get rid of medical scribes.
By creating a new profession, effectively, we are bypassing the physician, hospitals, clinics across the country input into the evolution of this product.
Gellert tracks and implements healthcare technology for the Christus hospital chain. He says we need those doctors complaining. Gellert says electronic medical record systems are sort of like cell phones in the 90s, clunky and time-consuming. Input from cell phone users on what worked and what didn't was the push that eventually led to the smartphone. But
if someone was there to manage all cell phone functioning, Would there have been the pressure to evolve cell phones? I suspect not.
One day, medical scribes might be innovated out of a job, but for now, many hospitals find them indispensable. Tyrell Kirchhofer says his shop is always hiring. In Cheyenne, Wyoming, I'm Miles Bryan for Marketplace.
We talk every now and then with Kate Betts, usually when there's a fashion thing I don't quite understand, or we need to explain why what's hot at Fashion Week is hot at Fashion Week. Kate's been a journalist in that world for a while now, a career she got started on in Paris, of course, not long after she got out of college. It's all recounted in her new memoir. It's called My Paris Dream. Kate, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with something your mom said to you as you were getting ready to go. There was a little waffling, a little, post-college angst, I guess. And
yep.
your mom finally gets fed up and says, you can always come back. Just go.
Yeah, she did. She had a big hand in my decision to do this. And coincidentally, that is the great journalistic mantra. Just go there, right?
Yeah.
So, and I wanted to be a journalist. So I guess I listened to her. Mother knows best.
always. You get there and you had some French in you, but not a whole lot. And you wind up learning from the kids of the family that you were staying with.
Yes, that is one of the great lessons of learning a foreign language, I guess. Not just the language, but the whole culture and the traditions and the codes, you know, the French codes. And my friend Tanya did say to me, you won't learn French unless you live with a family that has young kids. And she was right. And the kids only spoke in slang. And it's like a whole other language that you don't learn in school.
There is a moment in this book when you realize that fashion journalism is what you want to do. And it's when you're standing there talking to Yves Saint Laurent.
Yeah, that was a real moment for me because I realized that this was such an interesting subculture and such an interesting group of people and characters, and that you didn't necessarily have to be, you know, reporting from Hanoi to be considered a serious journalist. You could really write about anything. And if you did it in an interesting way, and if the characters were compelling enough, then that was enough for journalism.
And yet you say, you know, fashion is a world that grinds people up and spits them out in pursuit of the next product. It seems frivolous and deadly, deadly serious at the same time.
Well, it's a huge business, and it's also, you know, predicated on change, because if it didn't change, then we wouldn't need to buy anything new. So, yes, it's this ephemeral idea of, you know, you've got to have what's new, what's new, what's new. And people like Saint Laurent were incredibly good at mixing their own a sense of aesthetics with a sense of commerce and creating what's new and creating something that women had to have.
There's a thing you talk about as you were learning how to do fashion journalism. It's this thing, this idea that the next big thing in fashion is always based on somebody's hunch. And it's, I guess, the next big thing in fashion journalism, right? Is you finding the next big thing is going with your hunch, going with your gut.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true of anything in journalism. You have to be curious and you have to seek out stories and ideas. And I remember one of the great lessons from Fairchild that I learned, and I always pass this on to people who work for me.
Yeah. This is your time at Women's Wear Daily.
Right. He always insisted that we answer our own phone and always answer the phone, because you never know if it's your next story or your next scoop or where it's going to take you. And I feel like that's what it takes to find the next big thing in fashion. And then part of it is also just having an antenna that's highly tuned to an industry that is changing all the time. And always, you know, if everything is short today, then you know that tomorrow it's going to be long, because fashion always reacts against itself.
It's a book by Kate Betts called My Paris Dream. Kate, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, a coda of sorts to the AOL Verizon story that we started with. We had AOL CEO Tim Armstrong on the program about, I don't know, two and a half years ago. And I asked him, as I sometimes do with CEOs, to describe what his company does in five words or less. Here's how that went.
AOL will be the best connected, most shared, and most impactful brand and media company and with a technology platform in the world.
So based on today's news, here's another way to say that, I think. You ready? $4.4 billion. There you go. The Dow off 36 points today, 0.2%. The NASDAQ down 17 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 dipped 6 points. That is 0.3%. But remember, bonds, you guys. The 10-year T-note, 2.25% today. Caitlin Esch and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Madhavalan and Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. If everything works out, we'll be back tomorrow. And if it doesn't, I don't know. This is APM.